Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Our episode today is about the most notorious murderer in Los Angeles history. The subject of countless books, movies, theories, lots of intense speculation. The victim is a woman who has gained far more infamy in death than she ever hoped to achieve in Hollywood. Not only was her life taken in the most horrible way possible, and her name and reputation slandered, but her mysterious killer has been almost glorified in American crime mythology. Well, my guest today has put together formidable evidence that makes a stunning argument for who the killer really was, his father. I'm excited to be speaking to Steve Hodell, a private investigator and former Los Angeles homicide detective. He is also a New York Times and international best-selling author. His book, Black Dahlia Avenger, was nominated by the Mystery Writers of America as Best Fact True Crime Book. It's a great pleasure to have him with me here today. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, good to be with you, Eric.
So before we get to the actual Black Dahlia murder, there's a lot more that we need to set up. This is a really complex story. It's not only about solving a murder or even a series of murders, but it's about you and the relationship with your father, who you have proven is the murderer of the Black Dahlia, a.k.a. Elizabeth Short. But I want to ask you, before we get into that, if you wouldn't mind talking about your own life, how you grew up, and how you came to join the LAPD.
Sure. Basically born in Los Angeles in 1941. I had two brothers, and I kind of bounced all around. The first 10 years of my life, we lived with my father, who was a Dr. George Hill Hodell. He was a prominent physician in Los Angeles, head of LA County Health. And a little bit later, I can go into some heavy biographics on him, because he obviously, to understand this whole story, it's important to understand my father and his life. But basically, my mother had been married to the famous film director John Huston, who many of your listeners may be familiar with. He had a lot of African Queen, Treasure of Sierra Madre, Maltese Falcon, all sorts of classic films. And my mother had been married to John, who had been a friend of my father's as teenagers. And she divorced him after about 7 years of marriage and married my father. And soon after that, four sons were born to her. My older brother, Michael, was born in 39. He grew up to become quite a well-known radio announcer with KPFK, a local FM station here, and kind of dedicated his life to public service and the underdogs of life. then I came along in 41. My younger brother, Kelvin, came along in 42. Actually, I was a twin. John was only survived like 3 weeks. We were premature, 3-pound babies. So basically grew up in the L.A. Hollywood area, lived in this wonderful kind of Mayan temple mansion in Hollywood. Then my father left he left for Asia suddenly, and there were the three boys and mom, and we kind of bounced around, and I talk about this in my book as the gypsy years, bounced around in different areas of Los Angeles, kind of she was struggling to take care of three boys. She was an alcoholic, but also a screenwriter. So at 17, I decided I wanted to get off on my own and join the Navy. And right at 17, got her permission, was in for 4 years, got out, and thought I was a corpsman in the Navy. And when I got discharged, I took a job at a Kaiser Hospital here as an orderly, thinking maybe I'd go into medicine. But then the fates decided otherwise, and next thing I knew, I was joining the LAPD. And this would have been in the early 60s, 63. I actually went through the police academy and from there graduated and worked uniform patrol with LAPD for 6 years, then went into detectives at Hollywood, worked all the tables there, eventually graduated to homicide. And basically I spent my entire rest of my career, the next 17 years, working as a LAPD homicide detective. Out of Hollywood Division, which is like you call them precincts. We had 18 divisions in the city at that time, and that was one of the divisions, Hollywood. Over 300 murder investigations during my career, had a exceptionally high solve rate. I was running around 75-80% solves. So I had a great reputation, and basically retired from LAPD in 1986 after almost 24 years. Became a private investigator, had a couple of sons, and at that point decided to get out of the mean streets of L.A., and my boys were like 5 and 7, and went north to Bellingham, Washington, and became a PI, defense investigator at that time, and kind of became the only, it was a small town just near the border of Canada in Washington State, and raised my boys there, and basically got that 3 a.m. phone call informing me that my father had died, and he was, at that time, he was living in San Francisco in a high-rise, and I flew down and did all the things that a son has to do to take care of a father's passing. And from there, that started me into my investigations.
So you get the call, go back to California, and you meet with your father's widow, June. There, you're pretty much assigned the task of going through your father's personal belongings he had actually asked his wife to destroy after he had died. And one of those things was a small photo book. And one photo in particular inside kind of sets things in motion for you, doesn't it?
It does. And maybe it would be best to give your listeners some background on my father. He was, without question, the most remarkable man I've ever known in my life. And his background was so varied and so eclectic that you really, to understand what comes next, you really kind of have to understand the man himself. And if you like, I can go into detail as to his background.
Absolutely. So let's start with your father.
Okay, so George Hodel was born in Los Angeles in 1907. He was an only child, born in downtown L.A. at 5th and Olive, of all places, Clara Barton Hospital. His parents were Russian Jews. My grandfather, George Sr., was born in Odessa, and my grandmother was also born in Russia, and they met in Paris the turn of the century. My grandfather fled Russia just as he was about to be called into service for the army, and he managed to get out because Jews were treated almost like slaves in the service at that time, at the turn of the century, and he managed to escape on a train, dressed up, got fancy luggage, and said he was visiting his sick grandmother, and got out of the country, went to Paris, where he actually met Esther, my grandmother, who was there as a dentist. Very unusual. You imagine a woman dentist in 1901 Paris.
Right.
Very, very unusual. Brilliant woman. Anyway, they fell in love and got married, came through Ellis Island about 1902 or 3, and came out west to Los Angeles. We're in New York for a year or two. Then they came west to L.A. And George was born in 1907. Quickly, at age 6 or 7, he was identified as being highly gifted. He was a musical prodigy, playing his own piano concerts at the Shrine Auditorium at the age of 9, beating out adult pianists. Highly gifted, musical genius. They then soon discovered that he was also intellectually superior, tested out at 186 IQ, one point above Einstein. Incidentally, that skips a generation, so but my boys are in good shape. Anyway, the he went to South Pasadena Junior High, graduated there at the age of 14, and went to Caltech, which was one of our top technical universities here and highly respected in Pasadena. So he enters Caltech at the age of 14, and not only is he intellectually gifted and musically a musical prodigy, but he's also sexually precocious, let's say. Has an affair with one of the professor's wives at Caltech when he's 15, and she gets pregnant. He's that breaks up her marriage. She goes back east to the East Coast and has the child, and George follows her back and says, "I want to marry you. I love you." And she says, "George, you've ruined my life. You're a kid yourself. You know, go home. You know, get out of my life." So he comes back, and of course Caltech says, you know, because of the scandal, he was forced to leave after a year. And he hooks up, and he becomes a cab driver in L.A. We're now into the early 20s, mid-20s. And he gets a job. He passes himself off at 17 as 21, gets a chauffeur's license. He's driving a yellow cab. And then he gets a job with one of the top L.A. newspapers, the L.A. Record, which was here in L.A., and becomes a crime reporter. And he's riding around, this is during Prohibition, he's riding around with the LAPD vice squad. And they're kicking doors, and he's going in and taking names and writing these kind of tabloid articles in the newspaper. The judges was seen with a young blonde at drinking at the bar and stuff. And then he graduates and starts riding around with homicide, LAPD homicide guys, the big boys, and writes, again, these tabloid stories on these murders in 1924-25. Does that for about a year or so. And then he starts double dating with John Huston, who was at that time, of course, not the famous director, but at that time he was just the son of his father. Walter Huston was a very famous actor, stage and screen, one of the A-list actors of the day. And he was his son. So Dad and he were friends as teenagers, and they were double dating a couple of girls, women, young women, teenagers, 18 and 19, and one was named Dorothy, and the other was Emilia. Well, John and Emilia were dating, and George and Dorothy were dating, and then at some point after a number of months, they switched, and John fell in love with Dorothy. They ran off to Greenwich Village and got married at 18, 19, and Emilia and George were looking at each other, and I said, "I guess it's you and me." She gets pregnant. And George and Emilia go north to San Francisco, where Dad starts medical school, pre-med at Berkeley, 4 years there. He then goes across the bay to UCSF, San Francisco, to get his MD. And he's going through there, and he gets a job with the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper as a columnist. He has a joint co-byline with Emilia, and they're writing these columns. Actually, it's called Abroad in San Francisco, where they're writing about stories about different sections of San Francisco and the different ethnic communities and cultures and stuff. So he does that. He gets through medical school. And while he's in medical school, with all of his other gifts, he also has a natural ability as a surgeon. He has incredible eye-hand coordination. So his professors are vying for him to be their assistant because he's so naturally skilled in surgery. So he graduates in 36. Well, before that, he's actually a child is born to Emilia, which is Duncan, in 1928. He then has an affair with another woman at the same time, and a second child is born to him by the name of Tamar in 1935. He graduates in 36, so he's got these two small children, and he decides to take off, and he gets a job with the U.S. Health Department, doctoring to the at a logging camp as a surgeon. So he does that for a year or so. Then he goes and doctors to the Hopi and Navajo Indian reservations in New Mexico and Arizona. Does that for a few years, and then comes back to L.A., joins the health department, L.A. Health Department, quickly rises to the top. He specializes in VD, venereal disease control, rises to the top and becomes the VD control officer for L.A. County. At this point, Dorothy, John Houston's Dorothy, had been married to him for 7 years. They break up. She comes back, hooks back up with George, and my older brother Michael is born in 39. I come along in 41. And my younger brother Kelly is born in 42. So they get married, and Dad buys a Frank Lloyd Wright Jr. home in Hollywood. It's a Mayan temple. It's been used in quite a few of the films, L.A. Confidential and Aviator, and it's easily recognizable. It's literally a huge stone castle in the heart of Hollywood. Looks exactly like a Mayan temple. So Dad is now head of L.A. County Health, VD. He has his children there. And from 1945 to 1950, we have these incredible, he's having these incredible parties. The rich and famous are coming, and he's entertaining a lot of the film people and a lot of the politicos of the day. And then in 1949, there's a knock at the door of our home, and it's LAPD, and they say, Dr. George Odell, and he says, yes. He said, you're under arrest for incest. And they take him into custody. Well, you recall that Tamar, that was born in 35, she's now 14, and she came down that summer to live with us. And she runs away from home while she's living with us, and the police pick her up, and they said, why did you run away from home? And Tamar says, well, because my life is so messed up. And I say, what do you mean? She says, well... And then she reveals that her father had sexual intercourse with her with two or three other adults in the bedroom. So big scandal, newspaper articles, head of L.A. County Health arrested for child molestation, incest. Well, Dad, case is filed in court, and he's held to answer, and then there's a jury trial. And Dad hires Jerry Geisler, who some of your listeners may be familiar with, was the top criminal attorney in the nation at that time. He was kind of a Johnny Cochran of his day. And he hires him. There's a three-week trial, and they come back, and the jury comes back in about 45 minutes in kind of an O.J. decision, not guilty. With that, Dad shortly after that leaves the country and goes to Asia. Well, he actually goes to Hawaii, which was a territory at the time. Becomes a psychiatrist, then goes on remarries, goes on to Asia, and uses Manila, Philippines, as his home base, and gets into market research, kind of reinvents himself as a market research genius, becomes the leading authority in all of Asia on market research, which was just kind of born at about that time in the 50s, and has four more children, marries a wealthy Filipina. Actually, she becomes a senator, and has four more children, divorces her after about 4 years, 5 years, hooks up with one of his young assistants, secretary, June, a Japanese woman, who will spend the next 30 years with him. So he travels all over the world doing these market research for a lot of the top airlines and hotels and stuff. And eventually, in 1990, comes back to San Francisco after 35, 40 years. Although he was coming here every year or every 6 months or every year for short trips, business trips and stuff, he finally relocates to San Francisco in 1990. And I make contact with him. I start seeing him on a regular basis. I'm in Bellingham, Washington. I go down. He comes up. And we develop a very close relationship. At this point in his life, he's got 11 children by 5 different women, and he's living on the 39th floor of a high-rise in downtown San Francisco. So we see each other for the next decade. I spend quite a bit of time with him back and forth. We become quite close, and then I get that 3 a.m. call from June saying, "Your father's collapsed. The paramedics are here. They just pronounced him dead." I fly down and start to do what all sons do when the passing of a parent, and that pulls me into my investigation.
Was it difficult getting close to him, knowing what he did to your sister? Were there ever any conversations about that?
Well, you know, the story was that, what he presented to the world and to everybody else, including all of the other extended family, was that it never happened. That was his position. And that, you know, they painted, basically his attorney painted Tamar with as a pathological liar. And she was making it all up. It was all fantasy. And I was one of the few, and most family members believed it was maybe made up, that, you know, Dad didn't do it. Certainly all of the Filipino family believed that. My brother and I both believe that it happened, and because, you know, I considered myself a fair judge of people, and Dad was very eccentric, and I knew that he was, you know, obviously, you know, obsessed with sex, and so I was in full belief. I had never had any doubts that he did commit it, but a lot of others didn't believe it. So it was kind of a mixed bag for Tamar, and it, of course, impacted her. Even though, you know, the amazing thing was there were three adults present in the room during the sex acts, and they testified in court, and yet he beat it. We would later discover in my investigation that there were indications of a payoff.
From what you write in your book, the prosecution had an absolute slam dunk. Witnesses galore. Actual witnesses who were there in the bedroom testified, but his defense attorney really pulled off a coup.
Well, he really did, and we also learned that apparently $15,000, and you also got to remember back then in 49, L.A. was a real-life L.A. Confidential. I mean, there was a lot of corruption, a lot of the cops, everybody, a lot of the politicals, a lot of in the DA's office, everybody was getting payoffs. So it wasn't all that surprising. And she was, you know, she was this beautiful Marilyn. I mean, you look at pictures of my half-sister Tamar, and she looks like a little Marilyn Monroe. I mean, she was absolutely, you know, 14 going on, you know, 25 or whatever. So tragically, and her life because of that, I mean, because of those allegations and that she was labeled and painted with this a pathological liar brush, you know, her life kind of spun out of control, and she went to San Francisco and became, you know, one of the original bohemians and hippies and kind of sex, drugs, rock and roll type thing. So I had almost no contact with Tamar, really, for the first 50 years of our life. I mean, we just didn't. She went on to Hawaii and to have four children and all different fathers and stuff. So the only time I really connected with her was after Dad's death, you know, like 40 years, and then we started talking and comparing notes because she still loved her father, you know, and I had become close. So after Dad's death, in the weeks following that, we started conversations for the first time, and that also contributed. So maybe I'll let your listeners get an idea of what kind of the point is that this investigation came to me. I didn't go to it. Oddly enough, I knew very little about the Black Dahlia. I didn't even know the Black Dahlia's name, Elizabeth Short. I knew it was a famous whodunit from the 40s. But as a young homicide detective, I was concerned with the 60s and 70s and 80s, not the past. And there was never any indication that there was any connection to my family or anything while I was on the job. It was only 14 years into retirement that I would start to discover things.
We will be right back.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned.
So to bring it around again to that pivotal moment, you're going through your father's things and you find this little book of photographs. And as you're skimming through the book, you're shocked to find a picture who you later discover to be Elizabeth Short.
Right. So what happened was I go down and June is in, of course, a deep depression. They've been married 30 years. She was suicidal. She was going to take her life. And so I spent, you know, the first few days dealing with that and saying, no, you're younger than me, June. You've got a lot to live for. you know, kind of talking her through that. And then we're sitting there one evening, and she comes out and she actually hands me this little book that belonged to my father. And it's like 3x5 inch book. It was wooden bound. And it had a bunch of pictures in it, small pictures of my mother, my brothers and I, my grandfather. And I'm leafing through this book and turning the pages, and there were photos by Man Ray, who plays an important part in the story, who was a famous surrealist photographer, and he was our family photographer back in the 40s. And there are pictures by Man Ray of my mother and us boys and stuff. And I'm going through and I look and I see this photograph of a dark-haired young woman semi-reclining, and she was nude. And I turned to June and I said, "Who is this?" And she looked at it and she says, "I don't know. Somebody your father knew from a long time ago." But the face looked familiar. And I think, why do I know this face? Well, it clearly looked like a photo from the 40s. But I couldn't pull it in. And then, for some strange reason, Black Dahlia comes to mind. And to this day, I can't say for sure why Black Dahlia came to mind, but there was a film in the mid-70s, a television movie called Who is the Black Dahlia? And Lucy Arnaz played the part of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. And the picture was almost picture-perfect to her. It looked just like her. So I'm thinking, well, maybe that was the source of it, because I had seen that movie. But anyway, it was a passing thing. But then, 3 or 4 days later, I'm on the phone with Tamar, who's in Hawaii, and I'm talking to her, and we're talking about Dad and reflecting on memories and what a great man he was and all of this. And she comes out of nowhere and says, "Well, he was a suspect in the Black Dahlia murder." And I said, "What are you talking about, Tamar?" And she says, "Yeah, well, he didn't do it, but he was a suspect back then in the murder." And I said, "Where is this coming from?" She says, "Well, when I was picked up by LAPD on the runaway and made my disclosure, they told me, and we were going to court back and forth, they told me that, you know, he was a suspect in the murder." And, of course, you know, you think, well, why would this have never come up? Well, I don't think I had more than 30 minutes of conversations with Tamar in the previous 50 years. So we had, you know, gone on our separate routes in life and stuff. So anyway, there was that. And then I started looking into it, and I start researching, get online, and start looking at the case itself, and the next thing I discover. So that's the first or second blinking red light. And then I discover that the crime was committed by a surgeon. Well, Dad was a skilled surgeon in his early doctoring days. But still, it never occurred to me that he might be the suspect. I thought, well, you know, what's the deal here? Well, then what the real turning point was maybe a couple of weeks later. My girlfriend, who's living in Los Angeles, I had her send me up stuff from the LA newspapers, articles, original articles and stuff from the UCLA library. And she sends me one that's a front page and it's a note. Well, turns out the killer, Elizabeth Short's killer, the Black Dahlia, started sending in these notes, cut and paste notes like ransom notes and disguised handwriting and printings and stuff. And he sent in maybe a dozen in the 2 or 3 weeks following her murder to the press, taunting them, taunting the police, taunting the press, signing it Black Dahlia Avenger. And in one of these notes, most of the handwriting was disguised, but this one note wasn't, and it was on the front page of the newspaper, and it said, "Turning myself in on January 29th, had my fun at the police, signed Black Dahlia Avenger." And I look at the handwriting, and it's my father's handwriting. I mean, no doubt about it. You know your parents' handwriting, your listeners know theirs, and I know my father's. And I still said, well, wait a minute, this can't be. What's the deal here? Is he pretending to be? Does he know the killer? What's going on here? And at that point, I said, you know, I need to follow this up. So at that point, I basically decided to relocate back to L.A. and do a full bore, realizing I couldn't do an absentee investigation from Bellingham, Washington. And I'd been divorced and stuff, and my boys were off to school and college and out of high school. So I relocated back to L.A. in 2000 and began my investigation. Would spend the next 3 years, 2.5, 3 years, putting it all together, interviewing people, and eventually I went to the L.A. In secret, I went to the D.A.'s office to district head D.A. by the name of Steve Kay, who was one of the top. He was like the number three man in the D.A.'s office. He had he was probably the best prosecutor that they've ever had. He worked with Bugliosi on the Manson murders, just was a top-notch guy who I totally respected. We met in secret. I gave him all of my files and exhibits and said, here's the evidence. Take a look. So he did for a couple of months, got back to me and said, you know, unbelievable. He said, you know, were your father still alive, I would file at least 2 counts of murder on him. One for the Black Dahlia murder, Elizabeth Short, in 1947. And then the second one for a murder that actually occurred 3 weeks afterwards, which was a woman by the name of Jean French, which is known as the Red Lipstick Murder, where she was, you know, beaten to death, strangled, beaten to death, body posed on a vacant lot, just like Elizabeth Short's, 3 weeks afterwards, and the killer used lipstick and wrote a profanity on her body, taunting the police. And actually, what I had discovered, as if it wasn't enough that Dad was connected to the Dahlia murder and the French, but what I discovered was there were a series of lone woman murders that occurred in the 40s, all in a very tight geographical area in L.A., but from Hollywood to downtown to West Side. About 9 murders. And I put each of them together in different ways and felt he was responsible for at least those 9, if not more. So the DA basically says, you know, I would file these 2. At that point, I said, okay, I'll go public with this. And I wrote up my, and I wrote the book, and it came out in 03. And basically, as you know, it, you know, gained a lot of publicity. It was, you know, it was featured on Dateline and 48 Hours. They've done 5 or 6 different, hour shows on my investigation over the years for the last 14, 15 years now.
So let's talk about Elizabeth Short, who she was, how she ended up in Los Angeles, and how she was eventually found.
Sure. So Elizabeth Short was a young woman, 22 years old, who came out to Hollywood from Medford, Massachusetts. She was born in Medford, Massachusetts. It was wartime. Second World War was in full swing, and she dropped out of high school and basically came out to L.A. to meet Lieutenant Wright. Basically, she wanted to fall in love with a military man during the war and get married and live happily ever after. And she came out to Los Angeles and was living in Long Beach for a while. She was dating some servicemen down there. And then she came to Hollywood and was dating men and stuff and going to the military, the USOs and stuff. And basically she was kind of naive, young, naive, you know, 22 going on 14 maybe. Not at all ready for the shark-infested waters of Los Angeles and Hollywood. And she dated different guys and stuff. And then on the morning of January 15th, 1947, a woman was taking a stroller, taking her small child, daughter, to market. And she's in an area called the Leimert Park area of Los Angeles, which is about 5 miles south of Hollywood. And she looks over and she sees this, what she thinks is a mannequin on the vacant lot in this neighborhood. And then she looks closer and realizes that, no, it's actually a body. So she goes south to the first home, door knocks at nobody home. She goes to another home, of a Dr. Walter Bailey and his wife, and she has to use their phone. She calls the police, reports what she's seen. Police respond, and this begins what becomes L.A.'s most notorious murder of the century, and which is will become known as the Black Dahlia. Police get there. They're horrified with what they see. They see it at the crime scene. There's a body, a woman's body, young woman. She's a Jane Doe, no identification. And the body is carefully posed. It's surgically bisected at the waist. Skillfully, there's no blood. Clearly, the crime didn't occur there. Body has been washed clean. It's a horrendous sight. These are veteran, seasoned homicide detectives there, and they've never seen anything like it. Hands over the head are posed in a careful in a special position. The lower torso is juxtaposed just off the sidewalk, just below the upper torso. Signs of extended torture, cuttings to the body, ligature marks on the neck and the ankles and the feet. A hysterectomy has been performed on the woman, and cuttings. And then when they get to the coroner's office and they do the actual autopsy and protocol, they discover some horrendous things. She was actually forced to eat feces. They found some of her private parts in her rectum, and just on and on, this horrible, horrible murder, which is really what made it stand out from the others because of the extreme sadism involved in it. And they estimate that it probably was 3 or 4 hours of torture. And the one thing they were sure of, that this was a skilled surgeon, not some meat cutter, or, you know, that whoever had this had to be a trained, skilled medical doctor, or, you know, highly skilled in anatomy. She was a Jane Doe for just 24 hours, and then they sent her fingerprints back to the FBI, and they came back with a name and a positive ID. They learned her name was Elizabeth Short. She was 22. She had worked at a military base about 40 miles north of L.A., Camp Cook. She had worked at the PX there, the store, military store. And with that, they located her parents back in Medford, and her mother. And they learned her name was Elizabeth Short, and she was 22. And they started backgrounding, checking her, and they discovered, actually the newspapers were vying for headlines. This actually became one of the most media, it was a media, huge media coverage, 30 days above the fold on all 5 or 6 of the major newspapers here in L.A. at the time. It was just before, you know, this was before, just before television, so to speak, caught on, and it was kind of like the last major print story. And one of the reporters called a pharmacy that she was known to hang out, a soda place in Long Beach, and discovered that the military guys there called her the Black Dahlia. And that name came from a film that was out that previous summer called The Blue Dahlia, which was a noir murder mystery. And she would come in there and stuff, and they just kind of named her the Black Dahlia. So you got this mysterious name, the Black Dahlia. You've got this beautiful young woman. You've got this horrible crime, and they all came together to make headlines, and it just spun on and remained so for the next 30, 60 days, headlines not only locally but across the nation. So that's kind of what started the investigation, and it went from there.
The police had a lot of suspects to talk to, a lot of leads to follow up on, because, as you've mentioned, she dated a lot of guys, seemed to be constantly going out on dates at various nightclubs and restaurants, staying in different hotels, staying with friends when she was short on cash, which seemed to be frequent. So there were plenty of people to sort through for the police. And in addition, as you've already said, the killer was sending out notes to taunt the police and the newspapers. It's just pure chaos. Now, the killer even calls the editor of one of the newspapers one night to chat with him one-on-one, doesn't he?
That's right. The city editor receives a phone call from the actual suspect, and The killer says, you know, I understand you're having, you've hit a block, you know, a dead end. Well, maybe I could help you out. And city editor James Richardson was his name, says, how so? He says, well, how about if I send in some of her personal effects? Maybe that'll help you. And I'll send in a letter and her personal effects, and maybe that'll help you move forward on it. And the city editor signals to his secretary there to try and track the phone call. And the killer says, I think I'll hang up now. I'm sure you're going to try and track my phone. And he hangs up. Well, within two or three days, the city editor, Richardson, gets this package. And it's her personal ID card, social security cards, birth certificate, and some photographs from her purse, personal photographs of her with some other guys and stuff, with a note saying, here it is, promise to mail this to you, and here are some of her personal belongings, and he signs it Black Dahlia Avenger. So Richardson, you know, he kept that secret. Nobody actually knew that the killer called in. He kept it until about 7 years later when he wrote his memoirs, and he has a chapter on that in there, and he says, I'll never forget that soft, sly voice, he says, if he ever calls in again, but he never did. He thought he might call in again, but the killer never did call back. And again, a lot of the taunting notes were cut and paste and stuff and mailed to both the police and the press. It was very active, I mean, you know, hugely active for the first 6 months or so of the investigation. Then it kind of faded off, and every anniversary, like every 5 year anniversary on January 15th, the newspapers would, you know, resurrect the crime and remains an unsolved and stuff. And then of course from there, a number of books were written, fictional books. Probably the most famous is Elroy's Black Dahlia, James Elroy's, which is totally fiction. It has nothing, very little to do with the crime itself, except he uses her name, Elizabeth Short, and the location. But other than that, it's total fiction. It has nothing to do with a real story. But tragically, over the decades, you know, there's so much myth arises from it, and they turned her into a prostitute and a junkie and a dope fiend, and all of these, you know, terrible stories were created by hack writers. In fact, I spent a whole chapter in the book, you know, rehabilitating her reputation, because she wasn't a prostitute. She wasn't, she barely drank. She mostly drank just soda, Cokes. And she was a bit of a tease. She'd, you know, date a guy and stuff. But other than that, she, you know, none of the things that were ascribed to her in all of these very dark fictional books and in the films and stuff were true. One of the things that I do in the follow-up version is that there are a number of myths that I try and demyth. One of the big things that still stands to this day to many people is her so-called missing week. Supposedly from January 9th, when she was brought up to Los Angeles and dropped at the Biltmore Hotel, which is downtown at 5th and Olive, supposedly there's a missing week. From the 9th until the body was found on the 15th of January. And, you know, legend has it that she walked out the door of the Biltmore Hotel on the 9th and was never seen again, walked into the fog. Well, that's all totally untrue. And I was able in my investigation to locate and actually put together 14 different witnesses who saw her during that so-called missing week in Hollywood and downtown. And 7 of those 14 actually knew her personally, so they couldn't have been mistaken. So I was able to establish that there was no missing week, that actually the last person to see her was an LAPD policewoman downtown who talked to her, had a conversation with her. What we do know is that Elizabeth Short, in the last month or so of her life, began running. She was in fear of a man that was going to kill her, and she fled to San Diego, spent quite a few weeks down there, and then came back. And this policewoman actually saw her on the 14th, the day before the body was found, coming out of a bar. She ran out of a bar and said, there's a man in there that's threatened to kill me. And the policewoman goes back in. The man's not there, but they get her purse and stuff, and she talks to her. I was actually able to locate that woman. You imagine 50 years later.
Wow.
That was one of my most amazing interviews, was with this actual policewoman who was the last to see her alive before the murder. And there was no doubt in her mind. I mean, it's not like this might have been Elizabeth Short. This was Elizabeth Short. So that was one of the myths, was this missing week. The second myth that came along was the department's position was, oh, it's a standalone murder, none before, none after, one of a kind. Totally untrue. And as we've talked a little bit about the lone woman murders, there were at least nine that I'm absolutely considered definites. Two of those, of course, I mentioned that Kay said he would file. He liked the other ones, but he said there's not enough there to actually file, except on the two. Anyway, there was a bunch of these murders that, and it wasn't like Steve O'Dell is just saying this. It was actually LAPD at the time, back then, was actively investigating these as related. They didn't have the term serial murder back then, but serial killer, but they called them, and that, what was the thing? Oh, they called them chain murders. And they were definitely, they definitely had many of them, four or five of them connected. They even put out in the newspaper, they printed a 11-point paper on why they believed many of these were connected, listing 11 points of why they believed it was the same suspect. So, again, that was another myth that became, was lost in over the decades. And the other, and this we can get into later perhaps, is that LAPD never solved the crime. And, of course, they did solve the crime. And that's a whole section in itself that we would discover after my book comes out. So normally what was interesting about this case and my investigation was that normally in all my other murders, you start with a kind of a clean plate, a tabula rasa, if you will, and you move forward. Well, with this, I had to, separate the wheat from the chaff and figure out what was real and what wasn't, because there was so much myth and legend stacked upon it. I had to kind of clean the plate, so to speak, before I could move forward. So that added a unique twist to my investigation, which lasted, the first part of it lasted 3 years.
So as the police investigation continues, a man suddenly steps forward, claiming to be the murderer of Elizabeth Short. The newspapers, of course, trumpet the confession in their headlines. You write in your book that this confession from this kid might actually have been the catalyst for the red lipstick murder, a murder that you've already talked about, the victim, Jean French. Can you talk about that connection?
Absolutely. So, January 15th of 47 was the Black Dahlia murder, and the body was found. And then 3 weeks later, as I mentioned earlier, there was this body of Jean French that was found in West L.A., which was about 5 miles west of the Dahlia crime scene, almost in the same parallel spot, directly west by 5 miles. And the body was found on a vacant lot. It was nude, covered with her clothing. She wasn't surgically bisected, but she was had been strangled and beaten to death with probably a tire iron. And the obscenity was written in lipstick. It was F-U, black consigned BD, for obviously Black Dahlia. And what had happened was, there were a lot of confessing, what they were calling confessing Sams back then. People wanted their 15 minutes of fame, and they would say, I killed Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. So they were running around trying to interview and talk to these various false confessions. And then they got a guy in a military base back east, Private Dumas, and he claimed he killed her. And the military police back there interviewed him, and he wrote out, 25-page confession. And LAPD jumped on it, and as you say, it was six-inch headlines in the newspaper, Dumas, Private Dumas confesses, or Corporal, I guess he was, Dumas, confesses to killing the Black Dahlia. And they had this lengthy confession, all in print and stuff. It was huge and case solved. And basically, 2 days after that appeared, and LAPD kind of went along with it. And what had happened was one of the mystery writers, well-known mystery writers of the day, I'm blanking on his name right now, but he wrote into an article into the newspaper because they were asking different experts on their opinions on the Dahlia murder. And this one mystery writer wrote in saying, you know, basically what I would do if I were the police, I would claim that we've got a confession from a man, and he's confessed to the crime. And he says, this would so enrage the real killer that he would turn himself in to give himself up because he didn't want someone else claiming his murder. Well, unbelievably, the newspapers actually 3 days after this article, they did exactly that. They knew that this Dumas was not the true killer because the LAPD had established he was actually in his military base back east at the time of the murder. But they went ahead and printed this anyway, following this mystery writer's advice, thinking maybe the killer would turn himself in. So what does the killer do? Does he turn himself in? No. What he does is he commits a murder. And this is in response to the so-called confession. He writes on the body, F-U-B-D. And it's in response to their claiming, you know, rather than turning himself in, he just kills again to prove they've got the wrong killer. So that was pretty shocking. And the handwriting on the body, we haven't talked a lot about the evidence, but one of the things I did was I had a court-certified handwriting expert analyze my father's handwriting against many of the Dahlia mailings, and along with this one on the body, which was very clearly printed in a very unique, again, my father's unique printing. Anyway, she came back with highly probable that George Hodel wrote the message on the body. And basically, this was his way of taunting the police by killing again. And he would do it in other ways and other forms later on. And then there's a whole bunch of other things that ties him to it. The car that was Gene French was last seen was identical to his 37 Packard, black Packard. The description, he was seen eating with her at a restaurant at late around midnight that night before, fit his description perfectly, on and on, a whole bunch of reasons why. I just couldn't believe that that the newspapers would actually knowingly do this, and in a way you could say they were indirectly responsible for the tragic murder of a woman just because they were following this crime writer's crazy idea of getting him to confess.
So this episode today with Steve Hodel covers a good part of his first book, The Black Dahlia Avenger, although of course there's a ton that we were not able to cover in this week's episode. So this interview will continue next week, and in it we talk about some of the evidence Steve has gathered that points to his father George as the killer of the Black Dahlia, and other murders as well, murders in other cities even, other countries. We discuss motive too, so stay tuned. But my suggestion, if you want to continue to learn more about the murder and the investigation, is to sign up for a free Audible.com trial at www.audibletrial.com/mono. Mono, by the way, is short for most notorious, M-O-N-O. It's not pronounced mono, a disease that I do not have. You'll get a free audiobook with your 30-day trial, and hallelujah, The Black Dahlia Avenger is available as that free audiobook. 20 listening hours worth of information about Steve Hodel's brilliant investigation, which should keep you busy until next week when we talk about some of the more recent evidence not covered in the first book. So there, I've helped fill your weekend, and you can feel good knowing you've helped me and my little one-man operation stay afloat and keep this podcast going strong. This has been the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis. We'll continue this discussion with Steve Hodell next week on the Black Dahlia. And in the meantime, have a safe tomorrow.